Welcome to the ADHD Mums Podcast, a safe place for everyday Australian mums to discuss their struggles with ADHD, motherhood and life. Hello and welcome to another episode of ADHD Mums. Today is a really special episode. I had a lovely lady in our Facebook group, shout out to Liz, who asked in the Facebook group, I mentioned that we're starting season two, and she said, is there any way that you can do a summary of everything you've learned, what advice you would give, as if I'm having a coffee with you? I thought, that is an absolute great idea. This is going to be a summary episode over the past year. First off, I always had in my mind that I thought other people knew the answers. I felt like when I started this podcast that I would interview somebody who knew all the answers and I would be able to copy them and emulate them and I would have it sorted. I've interviewed a lot of Aussie mums, a lot of experts. No one claims to know the answer. Before and after the interviews, I usually ask a few questions. There's no one that has said to me, I've got this sorted. I've got it. Do what I do. One thing I really want to acknowledge before we start is that this shit is hard. It's fucking hard. There's no way around it. It's hard. I've had nearly 20 years industry experience in mental health. I have worked as a psychologist, and then I realized it wasn't for me. I am doing a master's in psychology at the moment. What I want to acknowledge is I have a lot of experience in this area. It's certainly an area of passion. However, I absolutely do not have this sorted. The experts don't have this sorted. If it feels really hard, it probably is hard. We know that one in 20 kids at the moment in Australia have some sort of additional need. And we know that the mothers feel or report feeling isolated, alone, hopeless, depressed, anxious. If you're not feeling good all the time and you're not feeling happy all the time, my personal view is that's probably pretty normal. So first off, I don't want to go into what I've learned as if I know it all and I'm killing it. I'm not. But I want to try and cut through some of the slow learning that I did with some bullet points of fast facts of things that I've learned that I think work. If I was to have a coffee with you for an hour and you had just got diagnosed, this is probably what I tell you. I'm going to go through a bit of a highlight reel over the last year and what I learned. I did a lot of research on masking and why women were not getting through the diagnostic framework for ADHD. So it's like, why aren't women who have ADHD getting diagnosed? And because when my psychologist said to me he thought I had ADHD, if he hadn't have been with me doing that criteria with me, I wouldn't have thought I had it. Even me and my knowledge, looking at the criteria, I was denying it. And then he explained to me what masking and camouflaging is for the first time, which then pushed me to put out Masking and ADHD, which was a solo episode purely off the research because of what he had said to me. And basically, I realized how many things I put into place to help me live my daily life and cover up my ADHD. I've been doing it for so long, I didn't know I was even doing it. When he pointed that out, that blew my mind. And then, of course, I wanted to share this knowledge because I thought other people are probably masking, camouflaging, and then probably going to seek help and then not receiving the help because they're saying, I don't do that. I'm not late. I know when my appointments are because of their complex systems necessarily. That there was a real game changer for me because I started to realize I actually do have a neurological condition. This is not me needing to try harder. This is actually me being a perfectionist, trying to meet society pressures of being a good daughter, mother, wife, not being able to, and then covering it up over and over again. One thing that I really want to highlight is when I met Tanya Waring. That was a real game changer for me. It was probably early in my podcasting experience, and Tanya Waring has got three kids. She's got one child that's particularly got a lot going on, and she's quit her job as a lawyer to advocate for him full time, and she's gone back to study psych now. And she really shifted a lot of my mind around schools. So I'd received a lot of feedback from the schools that we were at that no one there can't really help my daughter because she wasn't really showing enough help or need, and they were busy with the other kids, particularly boys, who were quite disruptive. And Tanya's thoughts on how the school system managed boys blew my mind. I felt like that was a real turning point for me, because I started to realize that my son, who was in prep at the time, was getting a different experience to my daughter. And when they say that they're helping the kids who are a bit more disruptive, are they helping or are they performance managing them out? Good question. I don't know the answer. Obviously, everyone's different. But that really shifted my brain a little bit around that. It's around about this time that I was also really struggling because my children had received diagnoses and I was receiving a lot of pressure. I felt pressure, internal pressure, to get through the NDIS planning process, to get the early intervention started. And that was a very draining experience. NDIS isn't necessary evil. I don't want to call it evil, but there is an emotional hangover from talking for hours and hours about all of your children's deficits. The assessment process is deficit based. You talk about your children negatively, everything they can't do. Then by the time you get to the NDIS appointment, you have to even talk about that. And everyone encourages you to talk about your worst day. So you can't even really say a lot positive about your kids. You want to really talk about the most negative day possible and what they could do, have done, not necessarily do all the time, but you really need to go there. I had to do that three times over because I've got three kids, and that was incredibly difficult. And if I could go back in time, I always shoulder load and I don't talk to people or tell them. I just shoulder it and shoulder it. My advice to anybody who's going through this at the moment is I think you should probably be honest. At least my hubby had no idea of how draining or what it was like. I didn't really tell him. I just did it. And the emotional hangover process from that was huge. Also, once we received our funds, I got a phone call from a provider, and I don't know why, I thought it was the NDIS, and they booked me out schedule-wise with just a heap of stuff. That sparked me to do episode, which is called Therapy Fatigue. I thought that was the best way forward at that point. I thought that was me doing the best thing by my kids. What it actually was me laying out on the ground like a sacrificial lamb, and I was just exhausted. Three kids, all the appointments, driving around after school. It was a nightmare and it was 100% not worth it. I would not get caught on that therapy train again. And I don't encourage anybody else to overcommit on therapy at the risk of your own energy, happiness, etc. I realized afterwards that I am the nucleus of the family. I am the emotional regulator for everybody. And when I'm running around like an Uber taxi every single day and then trying to entertain the other kids while the other one goes in, it was just ending me, and it wasn't worth it in my point of view. So basically, if something's not mobile, we just wait until we can find somebody who's mobile. The other thing that a lot of people have said to me is, wow, you're so lucky, you have such a great allied health team. Yes, but it's not out of luck. So pretty much what I do is I research heavily on the Sunshine Coast Mums page. You would have one in your area as to what is the best therapist, who's mobile. I ask questions, I watch, I search names, and then I wait for the right person. If I think I've got the right person and they're full, I just keep emailing them until they eventually have a spot for me. I do have a strong belief that squeaky wheel gets the oil. And for me, I know it's hard, it's tough work, but for me, what I have learned is that you're better off with a quality therapist that you see less or is harder to get a hold of than to starting somebody just to plug the hole and then realizing that it doesn't work. I also as well have gotten a bit jack of the initial appointment crap that you have to do. Sometimes I feel like it's a bit of a money grab from the NDIS. So, you know, people want to bill you for an initial to charge you a heap of money. What I usually do is I find a report now that I think is reflective of my child, that I think fairly accurate. And I say, read this and get what you need from it. Email me your questions. If you want to charge for an intro, go for it. But you can use that time reading all the reports and getting up to speed. I don't want you to bother me, because this might be controversial, but I think it's lazy. I think it's lazy from the practitioners. They just want to get you on the phone to ask you the questions. And then they verbally ask you, what's your address? What was your pregnancy like? Oh my God, can't deal with it. I won't do it. Just won't do it. I was doing it a year ago. I won't now. So when you're starting with a new therapist, you need to figure out a way that your child can get value for money that does not involve you putting in heaps of your time. I also, at that point, to be honest, was forcing a normal that wasn't there. I enrolled the kids in nippers, which was a disaster. I enrolled them in swimming lessons, which was also a disaster. And I enrolled them in things that I thought that they might like, because I don't think I was really admitting to myself who we were as a family and who my children actually were. I was just like, oh, that will be fun for us. Love to go to nippers. That's what I always imagined us doing. Yeah, I know now that's probably not going to be in our future. Major sensory issues, a beach, beating hot sun, three kids, so you've only got two of you, and then everybody needs you one-to-one. Absolute nightmare. Not worth it for me. Since that experience, I have really learned to basically strip it all back. My kids do one sport each. There's one training and one game, and then my little boy doesn't do any sport. He doesn't really want to, and I'm not going to push him for the fun of it. So stripping it back, prioritizing yourself and having more time together as a family and more times with your kids that aren't you running them around, getting them in uniforms, making them eat snacks, getting changed in the car, for me, valuable. I would never go back to the roller coaster of the therapists and the extracurriculars again. I would never do it. At the moment, we have a clinical psychologist that comes around. A lot of people, one of the most asked things is the family therapist that we use. How does it work? It actually really happened organically. This is the guy who diagnosed me. He's got six children. He so gets it. And he has family members with ADHD. He gets it. Initially, I was taking a child up to him at a time. The location wasn't great. It was very stressful. He's done me a solid and he actually comes mobile now, which is a miracle. So he comes in the morning before school. He comes early and then we try and get two kids out of the way. So every person in the family sees him every 2 weeks for half an hour. So he sees the kids in their natural habitat, which makes it a bit more realistic and he can see how things actually work in our house. And also he then gives me feedback about what's working and what's not working. I generally have 15 minutes with him at the end, which I just have a list and just do quick therapy, like what should I do with this, what should I do with that. He's very direct and he's more of a coaching psychologist. He really takes a look at the environment and just tells me, okay, this is what's working, what's not working. He will do ad hoc marital relationship stuff for me and my husband. He will do, okay, this child is having an issue with the other child, sibling rivalry. He does it all. You're probably wondering what his number is. He's very full. He's also local to me, so it'd be difficult. But what I would look for if I was in your position, what I think the number one therapy is, personal opinion, would be a neuroaffirming psychologist. I've noticed a lot of psychologists coming out now as neurodiverse. So a lot of psychologists are seeing themselves as having ADHD or perhaps they're autistic. I see that more and more now. What that does is it actually creates a community of care for us in Australia of other, and they're generally women because a lot of psychologists are women, but they could be men as well, that are neuroaffirming. If you don't know what neuroaffirming is, it's a pretty new approach. And Tanya Waring really changed my mind around the neuroaffirming. I'd never really thought about it before. Basically, I'm just going to probably butcher my definition of it, but to me, neuroaffirming means that there is nothing wrong with the neurodiverse child or adult. The idea in the past, I believe, has been, let's try and make this neurodiverse child more neurotypical to fit into the neurotypical world. So we know that the world is built for neurotypical people with neurotypical brains. We know that, which is why we have to mask scaffold to fit. And I often reference round peg, square hole with my daughter and mainstream schooling. But it can feel like that all the time. And I noticed recently there was a definition of joy. I heard Dr. Emily Musgrove on the Imperfects podcast. She was talking about joy from Jeffrey Jensen Arnett. He has a quote on joy. And it's the ideal fit between ourselves and the world around us at the moment. That's when you can experience joy. And it made me just stop in my tracks. And I thought, no wonder we're all, not all, I shouldn't say that. No wonder a lot of us feel depressed at times. And we know that it's very likely that autistic and people with ADHD or any type of neurodiversity are going to have other mental health conditions like anxiety, depression. We know that. So is it because the world doesn't fit us? Because the quote on joy is the ideal fit between ourselves and the world around us at the moment. I very rarely feel like that. And I do have trouble experiencing joy. Is that something to think about? So going back to neuroaffirming the approach, it's the idea that trying to get a neurodiverse person to fit into a neurotypical world is not actually the idea, because it teaches them to hide, mask, scaffold, and turn themselves into a knot to be accepted into a world that they generally find a bit more difficult than others. So the idea of neuroaffirming is that the child is perfect the way they are. There is nothing that we need to change in ourselves. And there's always that idea around the world should change to include everybody. We shouldn't continue to hold up this normal and then have a heap of people that don't fit, have to try to force themselves to fit, or they end up left out, excluded forever. Going back to what I was saying, I would be looking for a neuroaffirming psychologist. Reason being, because they will be able to help you and your family understand yourselves and empower yourselves. The other great thing about having somebody like that, and it's best to wait until you've found the right person. Don't jump in and just try and make anybody like a family therapist. You might find that some psychologists won't leave their office. They won't go mobile. They won't see the whole family at one time. So it's really a special person you're looking for. Obviously, try and get that funded through the NDIS. There is the positive behavior support that a lot of people have in their plans with their kids. It's basically because the NDIS have identified some behaviors that are dangerous or risky, and they give you some money under PBS, it's called. Personally, if I was looking, I would just be really aware of what applied behavior analysis is. If you get a family therapist or anyone through the NDIS that says that they'll come out and see you through positive behavior support plans, everybody's different. My personal view is that there's the applied behavior analysis, ABA is the acronym, and they have an approach to understanding and changing behavior in autistic children and children with disabilities. This is probably going to be controversial, and I'm probably going to get a heap of DMs about it. But my personal point of view is that at times, ABA it basically helps change your child's behavior. It aims to help children increase positive behavior and reduce negative behavior. It does this by reinforcing and rewarding positive behavior, so it's more likely to happen again. Negative behavior doesn't get attention, which means it's less likely to happen again. So it's like training a dog. You reinforce the positive behavior, you ignore or punish the negative behavior. That's not something that I personally would do with my children. I believe that children's behavior comes from somewhere, and I personally am more comfortable going into what are the sensory preferences of that child? What is it about that environment that's not working for them? Why are they reacting the way that they are reacting? Dr. Ross Green says that children will do well if they can. It's a really different way of looking at it, and I know it can be a bit out there for some people, but I believe personally that all children will go well if they can. I don't believe there's any child out there that goes, oh, I just thought I might just hit somebody today. I don't believe that, but I believe that neurodiverse children often have a lot more going on that they don't let on. It might seem like they've just walked up and just punched somebody or hit somebody at home, or they're behaving badly. I'm not talking from a perspective of somebody that doesn't have kids that have done things that have shocked me and others who haven't hit, bit, done things. I've seen it. It's happened, and I get it. I get it. I've got two boys. I don't have a little girl who just sits and plays piano and draws. I get it. Boys are a different beast, and some of them can react. Or girls the same. So personally, one of the best things I've done in the last year is get a family therapist. I would look for a neuroaffirming psychologist, counselor, or I would send through what neuroaffirming therapy is and ensure that they do it. Obviously, experience with neurodiversity, perfect. Personal experience, even better. I would always go with a parent. I haven't had that greater experiences with therapists that don't have children. That's just my take on it. ABA works for some people. There's nothing against it. Check out the website. And if you are okay with the ABA style, fine. Make sure that if you are not okay with that approach, that you don't get somebody that has studied and believes in that practice. The reason I mention it is because I've had people send me messages before. They've got a positive behavior therapist coming out. They work with the whole family, and they find that they don't agree with the approach. and that they don't feel comfortable giving no attention to a meltdown or whatever it is the therapist is saying. The reason I mention it is because I don't want you to feel that just because that person's a psychologist or a counselor, that they know what they're doing better than you do. If there's anything that you don't agree with as a mother, follow your gut. It wouldn't matter to me if I had Dr. Ross Green, one of the child specialists, the best one in the world. If he came and I did not fundamentally agree with what he was saying, I wouldn't follow it. So you really need to be comfortable with who you've got in your house and who is really guiding your family through this. If you can, start to integrate therapy into your family routine. I have gone through the phase of dropping a child off like a hot meat pie or a bag of potatoes, fix that kid. I went through that. I was treated like that as a child. I don't do it that way. Yes, my children do receive individual, but they generally do it mobile if I can. I will take him to an office if I can, but I'm also really in communication with that therapist and we are actively doing things at home. So a lot of the work I have found, especially with kids, can be emulated at home. I've definitely done a couple of speech therapist sessions and then gone, they're just using this app. I'll just download it for $100 and do it at home with them for half an hour. And often spending that time with your children when they're younger and they actually want it to be you is great. Because it's not time away with you, it's time in with you. And that can be really difficult to coordinate with multiple kids, okay? And I can hear in you, okay? I've ended up really using the iPads as a way of mitigating this, particularly when my husband's not home. So let's say if I have to do 20 minutes of speech with one of my kids on an app, I will put the other two on a iPad with the timer on. I have a parental control app on my iPad. It's called Our Pact. OURPACT. I'll put it in the episode notes. This is not a paid partnership. I use it. I love it. I pay full price. I'll do like a 15-minute timer, 20-minute timer, 30-minute timer, and then I'll rotate the kids around to actually be able to have some one-on-one time with them. Just taking one kid off and doing something with them by themselves and leaving the other two unmonitored doesn't work for me anyway. So I've had to do structured activities like that. And even though it might seem like an extra thing to do, for me, I'd prefer to do that at home than to drive my kids around appointments, feed them snacks, and try to control them in a waiting room. That does not work for me. For me, when I made that discovery and I was going down that path, I also recorded an episode with Tanya Waring. She's a meltdown specialist. She's actually doing her PhD in meltdowns in the classroom and how they can be managed. She gave me a lot of tips around meltdowns, particularly, for example, traveling in two cars. It's very difficult for us to travel in one car because of the fighting, the screaming, getting everybody ready. Let's say sports on Saturday, you've got to get one kid there on time. One won't walk, one won't get in. It just means you've got a lot more breathing space. Tanya gave me a lot of tips that have stuck with me. It's one of the episodes that I learned the most from. Another real highlight for me, Jasmine Meek. She emailed me and said, do you want to follow my diagnosis journey? I thought, yes, that sounds fun. And you know what? It was actually a really great insight into how bad it can be because her three-part series, oh my God, what happened to her was horrible. I'm going to put that in the episode notes as well. So the part about Jasmine that I thought was really interesting was it was like medical gaslighting and also I suppose just a sheer lack of the diagnostic framework, the fact that she didn't have enough childhood symptoms to get diagnosed, even though she definitely had ADHD. It does have a really great ending, part three. She does get diagnosed and she is medicated and it absolutely changes her life. But watching that play out and seeing her after the second recording, I was worried about her. I sent her a lot of messages, a lot of phone calls because I was really worried about her mental health and I was worried she wasn't safe. And it's been great to see that play out and finish, but it really showed me that we've got a lot of work to do. I got Millie Carr in. She writes children's books. She did a episode on the neurodiverse classroom. Blew my mind. I think it was because it was following up Tanya's episode and that started getting me really thinking about the education system and a lot of the things that I'd been thinking and wondering, and I've been hearing all of the excuses from the school. We can't do this because we can't do that because we can't do this because, well, you know what? Millie Carr is a teacher in a primary school And let's have a listen to what she's doing, because actually the modifications that she spoke about were not that big. They were small. They don't cost a lot of money. They don't take a lot of the teacher's time. But it was a way of looking at how can we teach more inclusively for everybody. This is not about sectioning off 10 kids out of 20 that are neurodiverse and giving them all this special stuff. This is just about teaching in a bit of a different way. And I've never known, or I've never seen a neurotypical person not love the inclusion changes, like having smaller numbers or better lighting or child-centered approach or a bit of a walk and a run for a bit of breath of fresh air. Millie's take on it was refreshing, and it sat with me. When I heard her talk, it just hit me that we can do things differently, because I felt like before I spoke to her, I was really conscious that it's not the teacher's fault. And I didn't want anyone to think that I thought it was the teacher's fault, because I actually haven't experienced many teachers not having in their hearts in the right place, not trying their best and not being great people. It just always felt to me they were under-resourced. They had too many kids, which, you know, I think most of them would actually agree with me. So when I interviewed Millie Carr, it was really refreshing, because I didn't want anyone to think that I was blaming the teachers, and Millie gets it. That for me was a gear shift in that we can do things differently. We're just not. Why? You have ADHD, or is this mum life? I don't know. I never want to say favorite, but that'd still be one of my favorite episodes. I put a call out somewhere, I think it was on Instagram stories, that I wanted to interview two people, one who had ADHD and one who didn't, and go through the morning routine, the lunch routine, the afternoon tea, how they do things to actually show the difference. It was one of the funnest episodes I've ever done. And I interviewed two friends, Amanda and Sarah. If you are still wondering if you have ADHD, it's pretty clear the difference. I thought it was great because I started to be more in the middle because I'm medicated. Like, I could actually see Sarah, who was neurotypical. I could actually see how she was doing the things that she was doing and how she was creating calm and how she was creating structure. But a man who had ADHD couldn't even fathom how Sarah was actually doing those things. So I thought it was interesting how the ADHD brain, where I was definitely was identifying with Amanda, with medication can start to look more neurotypical. If you haven't listened to that one, check it out. It was one of the most interesting ones I've done, highly camouflaging with Millie Carr. I had raging PMS and I was in full rage. And I think her and I got on a rant about the fact of why women aren't diagnosed and girls aren't diagnosed as often, why they aren't picked up, and how as parents get turned away, which has happened to both Millie and I. And it was great to talk to somebody like-minded who gets it. It really goes into why. Why are women still not getting through the diagnosis framework and being pushed and turned away? Why are girls still being told from the GP that they don't need a referral for a pediatrician? And what is it about society expectations and females that we turn ourselves inside out to behave perfectly or be the right student or have the homework done, even though we've turned ourselves into knots and it looks like everything's okay from the outside? One of the best tips I got from last year was with Sharon Collins. We actually unpacked some of the situations I find myself in constantly. For example, I would have two kids that would physically fight within 300 meters of the school. I'd be trying to drive and they'd be across the back screaming at each other. And she had a lot of really simple tips, take snacks with you to pick up. And I found that changing the way that I do things and feeding them straight away, for example, actually really has them all regulated before we even walk in the door. So there's a lot of really practical tips, because perhaps the expectation for my children to jump into the car and tell me happily about their day is not realistic for them. I have one son that doesn't eat or drink all day because he's too distracted, and he gets in the car and he's just done and he's starving. And then he has to wait 10 minutes for me to go home. That doesn't sound very long, but for him, he's off his tree and it causes chaos. And I end up yelling, nearly crashing in the first 20 minutes of having my kids, which is a horrible way to start the afternoon. So that was a real game changer for me. I also did a relationship episode with her, and she talked about, she's neurotypical, about being in a relationship with her husband with ADHD. And that really shifted my mindset to around being in relationships. My husband has ADHD as well, but he is a really inattentive type and I'm really hyperactive. And that can also mean conflict because we're diverse but different. And the way that she is curious and compassionate to her husband, I found really empowering and refreshing to hear. And I loved what she said. That changed the way I viewed him. And I suppose I started to see how hard it would be for the other person to be in a relationship with. I can be patient with my kids, but maybe I'm lacking patience elsewhere. And because I'm so hyperactive, I have a complete lack of understanding of why he sits on the couch when he's got all this stuff to do. And because he looks motionless and he's scrolling, I assume he's relaxed, but he's not. He's actually really stressed out. And getting a different perspective from Sharon really helped me with some of that. I love that. That was her relationship episode. Shortly after this, there was a major breakthrough for me where I talk about this a few times. So I'm not going to go into too much detail in case you've heard it, but basically I have a friend who was about to have a baby and she was putting all this pressure on herself to be this most beautiful present mother and never wish the time away and be more grateful and blah, 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 blah. And I listened to a talk and I said to her, I just think you're putting too much pressure on yourself. She doesn't have ADHD or anything. This is just a friend. And well, who knows? Anyway, and I said to her that I felt like I was at about 30%. I enjoy about 30% of motherhood at the moment. And I thought afterwards, I wonder how other people feel. Do they enjoy everything? How do they go? What does it look like? Am I alone in this? I put it out on Instagram stories, received a huge response, and I don't think there was anyone over 50 or 40%, and there was a lot of people that I needed to check on via DM. They were not in good way. And that began the I Hate Motherhood series, which I have renamed now the Untold Tales of the Struggles of Motherhood or something that doesn't sound as negative. I'll put all this in the show notes, by the way. There's a 3-part series. And it's about women who talk candidly about actually how they feel. If you want to listen to a bit of a vent from somebody and feel like acknowledged that it's hard and a lot of people don't love it, and it's like the opposite to the social media post of people standing around in straw hats with long flowing dresses, clutching their babies that all look perfect and they just look so happy. And then you just wonder, is it just me that's struggling, that looks like a bag of shit and your kid won't stop crying? It's pretty much that in a podcast episode. I really enjoyed recording them. I also noticed as well, having taken meds for a long time, that there was a really strong correlation of addiction and ADHD. And some of the others go into addiction. So food and alcohol. I've definitely been in places in my life where I think I've drunk more than I should. There's binge drinking and not knowing where to stop. Yes, I've done that too. But then there was also the cumulative effect of needing a glass of wine at the end of the day, needing two, needing three, because I just felt so unhappy. For me, medication changed a lot of the drive around drinking. And that's really turned me full cycle. I interviewed a few people on these addictions and binge eating particularly. I thought that medication plus doing therapies on plus getting help for yourself around binge drinking and eating works. Again, medication works best when it's hand in therapy. I don't think just taking a pill and then doing the same things is going to work. But sometimes if your brain is wired differently, not taking medication and just putting steps into place might not work to stop some of the addiction. Using them together, I think, really works. Again, medication for me has been really life-changing. There's been things that I've been able to do, therapies I've been able to do on myself that I've actually had the time and space and organization to do, as opposed to just taking meds and not doing anything or doing therapy and then not taking medication. I think probably the combination of the two is a real winner for me anyway. Obviously, not everybody can find the right meds. In regards to medication, back to episode 20, medication and psychiatrists, it's very much the old saying, you want to put on your oxygen mask before trying to help others. if you're prioritizing everybody else and not helping yourself, you've never tried medication, you don't have the money to find the right one. It's hard, but I probably, if it was me, my advice a year later would be to medicate yourself first. Feel how it feels, find the right one, because you are the nucleus of the family. You are the emotional regulator. And if you can feel better within yourself, you might find that your children go better because you're more regulated. It also helps with the executive function around having the time and the space to do therapies with your kids, to sit down and do the iPad for the speech, or integrate the therapies or call people back. I really struggled to do that stuff without medication. If you can, try to keep going. It took me 3 or 4 appointments to try and find the right medication. When I found the right one, it was certainly worth it. So I wouldn't just try one and then just say it's not working for me. It is worth going back. And then at least you've done everything you can. And then maybe you then try a non-stimulant medication. But obviously that journey is very personal, but I do think it's worth exploring all the way if you can. Also throughout this, Tanya Waring did an episode on school advocacy. That was really great. It helped me and educated me into how to handle myself in the school environment, how to get the best result, because it's difficult not to fly off the handle. It's difficult not to get emotional. Tanya gives some really great tips around advocacy because she's certainly done that a lot for her kids. So that there was a great episode too, an interesting one with Dr. Jacinta Thompson. I love having her on. And I went in really excited because we wanted to talk about ADHD and being autistic. And a lot of people were writing in and saying to me, thought I just had ADHD, but my kids have also been diagnosed autistic. And now I'm having all of these sensory issues. And I don't know, am I autistic too? Is there any point finding out? And I've got these new things that I'm left with. Dr. Jacinta Thompson, oh my goodness, she changed my world. She talked about ADHD shielding at times. So sometimes ADHD can be like a social shield. It can create excitement and impulsivity, and you know, you just want to share with people. So when you're in a group, you might handle yourself well. You might be a bit much, or you tell long stories, but you feel good about yourself at least, possibly. But she wanted to talk about the autistic experience, and I thought I had just had ADHD. So we were going to talk about the similarities and the differences, but every time we had a scenario, I was actually identifying with her. And then I realized at the end of the episode that she was the second person, the second psychologist to tell me that she indicated to me that she thought it might be good for me to go do my own assessment. So it started to really hit home that possibly there was a little bit more going on than what I had thought. That led me to seek my own assessment, and I was diagnosed autistic. However, I am still in imposter syndrome with that. If you don't know what that is, it's when you think that everyone else has it worse than you. So it's something that newly diagnosed autistic experience, or ADHD, is, or really anybody. It's just that feeling of you wonder if you really are autistic, or you're not really autistic enough, or you question whether there was a mistake and you're not really autistic. So I'm still sitting in that space. A few people have said to me, you could sit there for 6-12 months. You might be longer. Who knows? You might get through it quickly. I'm still sitting in that space. So that's why you hear me talk about it, but then not talk about it. But season 2 of this podcast is definitely going to go more into the autistic mum experience. It's going to really explore that more deeply. There was a lot of people that, when I put out on Instagram stories, has anybody got autistic tendencies after taking ADHD meds? And 99% of people said, yes, they do. So I'm assuming this is affecting a lot more of us than what we think. So if you are listening to the episodes moving forward and you're thinking, oh, gee, I'm really resonating with this autistic mummy experience, that might be something that you want to look into. Obviously, to go through a diagnosis to see if you are autistic or not is time and money. And then at the end of it, you may not feel that you've gotten a lot out of it. For example, especially if you do get diagnosed autistic and then you sit in imposter syndrome for a while and it's cost you $2,000, for example. There are psychologists, if you just want to know, that will go through that pretty cheap for you. So, you know, they'll give you a big discount. They're not doing a big report for the NDIS. There are a lot of autistic women who are trying to get on the NDIS at the moment. I think they're making it harder and harder to get on there. Typically, you do have to be a level 2 autistic person to get on the NDIS. Why there's levels and how that works is not up to me. I'm just going to leave that there. But a lot of women are saying they don't think they're going to get a lot of help anyway. I think if you go and see the right clinical psychologist, they might be able to go through some of your scaffold masking, camouflaging, and you might end up with a level two. You don't know how your assessment's going to go. So you might end up with an NDIS package. It's hard to know, but it's certainly worth finding out. There's a lot of women on the podcast who've messaged me that have successfully got onto the NDIS, going through an assessment. Some of them are working, they have kids, and they've just gone to a really great report writer who has managed to help them. Always worth checking that out because there's a lot of benefits being on the NDIS, and there is some really great services that can absolutely help you if you can. Then we went through the homeschool episode. I said this to Nikki openly from the Wildlings that I didn't really think the homeschooling episode was going to apply to me until I started talking to her and I realized that we were two peas in a pod and actually homeschooling is a real option. The reason that I spoke the way that I did in the episode and was because I wanted people to see there were more options. Sometimes we feel stuck. It's mainstream schooling or nothing. You have to go to school. There are other ways to do it. And I suppose I just wanted to air that. That was a real game changer for me. When I interviewed Bessie Campbell, Life as an Attentive Mum, I actually heard for the first time what a meltdown in a mum would look like or a shutdown. And meltdowns are typically like you can physically see it a little bit more. They might do things outwardly, stim, yell, say phrases. That's the stigma around it, is they might hit somebody or punch somebody that tries to touch them or punch a wall or something. I thought it was really incredible to listen to Bessie talk about what a shutdown is like for her as a mother. That was a big episode. I love that. She's both autistic and has ADHD. Also, I published an episode on my change of mind around medication. That was a really big shift for me. I always said on all of the podcasts that I didn't feel that my children need medication. I would medicate them in the future when they need it, but I didn't think they needed it right now. When I sat down with our pediatrician, who I waited a long time to get in with, but I actually trust, the reason I waited so long and I wanted to go with someone was I trust because I actually wanted to listen to what she said and do it. I didn't want to go to somebody and then ignore their advice. And for me, because I'm quite knowledgeable in the area, I do need to go to somebody that I trust because I want to learn and I want to respect them and know they're amazing. Because sometimes in this podcasting experience, I listen to a lot of stories about practitioners that don't necessarily have the newest information, that are not up to date. And then that gets in my head and I don't want to use practitioners or providers that I don't know are really good. If you listen to the medication episode on What Changed My Mind, you'll see all the research there. It's very well documented that I believe that basically a child's brain can change. I think if you look, and there's studies around, this isn't me talking from my spiritual journey that I heard about on TikTok. This is research-based, that if you take a child's brain that's neurodiverse, it is smaller, it does not function as well, than a neurotypical child's brain. If you medicate a child properly with the right dose and you do the therapies, by the time they are in their early 20s, when their frontal lobe develops fully, you may find that they have a neurotypical looking brain and they may be able to come off meds. It also looks at the outcomes, the unemployment, the schools, the overall happiness and success of a child has been mapped in a longitudinal study and definitely says that meds are the right thing to do. That's my personal opinion. It's based off research. It's all in that episode. It changed my mind. I was in the right place to hear it at the right time. Everyone's different. It's just an option and it's not an option I thought I would do. However, since medicating two of my children, because my youngest is not six yet, which is when you generally start, it has been really life-changing for our family. And I feel like the therapies that we were doing before are actually going in a bit better. I feel like expecting one of my children to stop and listen before doing things that are unsafe, for example, are a lot easier for him to stop and listen with a medication that is for impulsivity and hyperactivity. It's easier for him to do that. And then my responses to him are more positive. I talk to him positively. I feel like the messages that he gets at school are positive. And that for me is really important. Again, obviously every child is different, but it changed my whole perspective. And I wish I had have known that a year ago, which is why I mention it now. The other thing I will say about medicating children is that I would always do your research first. Ask in Facebook groups, really research the pediatrician or the child psychiatrist, like fully, and go in there educated on what you think might work or what you've tried. Often they're trying their best, but they don't know their child as well as you do. So don't see yourself as anything else but an expert on your own child. Yes, they're a pediatrician, but you're an expert on your child. So your opinion matters, and go in there knowing that. I have had multiple appointments with the pediatrician, and I have had scripts given to me by her that I've not filled for each child. And I've gone back in the follow-up and gone, look, I'm sorry, I'm not comfortable with that for these reasons. I would like to try this. And when I've spoken to her openly, showed her my own research, talked to her and really aired out what I think, a couple of those times she's actually come back and given me information that has changed my mind. And I'm like, okay, actually, I think you're right. Or, oh, okay, she's okay, when you say it that way and you show me this from the teacher, maybe you are right. Maybe we could try that. So you're like putting two brains together. You're putting an expert on medication and development with the expert brain of someone who knows their child inside and out. And that there is a good combination. I don't think it works as well if you've only got one. You need to have you. You're the expert of the child and they're the expert of development and medication. Together is a good result, but don't let them make the decisions without really researching and having a think about it, because we know our kids best. Also, before you go into a diagnosis appointment with a pediatrician or child psychiatrist or a psychiatrist for yourself, if you think they might have ADHD, look up the criteria first. Go through some self-tests. Look up camouflaging if you've got a daughter and masking or a son that do that. And be armed with examples. I think sometimes the expectation that they're the practitioner, they're the doctor, they are going to problem solve this with me might not be true. They will ask you questions off the criteria, like, do they often lose things? You may say honestly no, but then you would need to say, I help them with that. Their teacher helps them with that. We check their bag because they don't have all of their things all the time. No, they don't lose things because I have air tags on everything. Really think about things before you get there. And I acknowledge we have ADHD. It's hard. It's hard. I get it. If you can medicate yourself first, it does make it a bit easier, or try and do changes or body double with a friend. I have to get organized for my child's appointment. Please, can you come over? Because it is important and it will get you a better result. I think some quick tips from me before I finish up would be, a big takeaway I've got this year was awareness. It is important to be aware of yourself and the way your brain works. It's important to be aware of your husband and how his brain works and your kids. I really believe that we are all doing the best we can do. And being aware of the way somebody works matters. So for example, my husband's inattentive. So when we break up the household duties and chores, I always try and give him things that are time sensitive. Because if I give him a job like, the roof is a bit moldy, can you get it fixed? He won't do it. But if I give him, could you buy food for the week? Even if he forgets, at some point we all start starving and he gets onto it. So just be aware of the tasks that you're doing and your children and your partner and where people's strengths and weaknesses lie, and play to those. Don't give people in your family jobs that they can't do. Don't give yourself jobs that you're not good at, don't enjoy. Try and break it up. And if there's something that nobody wants to do, try and outsource it if you can. The other massive thing that we talk about a lot, that a lot of the ADHD experts that I've had on talk about, is compassion. And that just goes around and around. That is still, for me, a lifelong journey. I think neurodiverse people are incredibly critical on ourselves. That, for me, is still a bit of a reach. That's easier said than done. I find that really difficult, but I can also see the importance. And I'm hoping that next year, when I'm doing the recap for this season, I can say that I've done it, or I'm doing it, as opposed to me struggling and still not quite getting there. We all throw around the self-care word, and I hate the self-care word. And I think one of the reasons I feel quite angry towards it is because there's just such a lack of it. And having someone take your kids so you can go shopping by yourself for food for the family or clean, it's not self-care, but it's a reality of so many of us. I think more bullet points is I was a real anti-iPad person a year ago. It would have to be dire for me to pull out an iPad. It was really infrequent. And my best friend said to me, I don't know how long ago, Jane, I don't know why you don't just pull the iPads out. You put so much pressure on yourself. And she's right. So we have upped some of the iPad use. For example, getting my kids ready in the morning is just a nightmare, and telling them that they can have their iPad for as much time as they're ready for means that everybody's ready early so they can get the maximum amount of time. And it just means it's an easier morning. Also, in regards to schools, no school is perfect. I haven't met anybody who's entirely happily with their school. I think it's like work. It's always going to be tough. You just got to pick the best of the best and do with it what you can and advocate the best. School can't is a real thing. If you have children that cannot go to school, that might be really real for them. I had went through school can't for 2 years. It did a lot of damage on my mental health. If you have children that is in school can't, it is a real thing. And I think it's worth looking into other options in your area. I've also noticed this year how often I go and do something else instead of acknowledging my own problems. And I think people with ADHD seem to do this a lot. I think for me, those would be the key learnings that I've had over the past year. It's hard, hey, because I hate pulling out episodes and then not mentioning other people. The podcast community has been amazing. I get so much back from this community. And I really want to acknowledge how grateful I am that everybody has listened to this podcast, reviewed it, joined the groups and sent me the DMs and volunteered to come on and be a guest. Without you guys, it wouldn't happen and I wouldn't continue. I really want to extend gratitude to that percentage of parents that have chased this further enough along to realize that they might have ADHD. It's so easy to bury your head in the sand, and I reminisce about the times that I didn't know that we were all neurodiverse, because it seemed like it was a lot simpler. I'm glad that we know, and I think we'll all have better outcomes. Thank you so much for listening.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums Podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.